Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. It's very easy to forget, isn't it? To forget the Dhamma, to forget how rare and how precious it is to have the chance to hear these beautiful teachings. It's very easy to forget all of the very many conditions, many apparent accidents, and all of the things that's happened in our life to bring us to this place, to bring us to encounter the teachings of the Buddha. Easy to forget and hard to remember. One thing goes wrong, we lose our mindfulness. And a million things can go right and we don't get it back again. There's a tendency, as was mentioned in the psychology conference on the weekend, this tendency that we tend to focus on the negative and overlook the positive. I think Eng Kong once quoted some statistics saying that if you get criticized just once, you remember it, but you have to be praised 5 times to remember it, even that one criticism. So let me just do this 5 times just for now. You're all wonderful people. Amazing, marvelous, special people. Unique, irreplaceable people. You're all full of kindness and love. And you all have much to offer the world. So there's 5 true compliments. They have to be true, by the way. It can't be fake. So there's 5 things which are all true, and that it's very easy to forget it, and we pass over how special it is, how much gratitude we should have for just the little things. I remember the very wonderful story of somebody who was staying in the monastery one time in the time of the Buddha, and nobody wanted to ordain him because he was just pretty hopeless and pretty useless and obnoxious. Nobody liked him. Nobody wanted him to be a monk. And then the Buddha said, you know, can anybody remember anything good that this person's ever done? And Venerable Sariputta said, oh yes, I can't remember what it was now. I think he gave me a lump of rice on alms round once or something like that. Did a small thing for me one time. Even though it was many years ago and he's done lots of obnoxious things in between that. But it's that one good thing that I remember. And so on the basis of that they thought, okay, well, I'll give him the ordination. So this is the paradox of the Dhamma. That Dhamma is actually all around us all the time. We're swimming in an ocean of Dhamma. We're drowning in it. Everything we've always seen, our whole life is Dhamma. There's nothing else that isn't Dhamma in the world. And yet, it's still so hard to make it out. It's so hard to discern it. You know, think of all of the effort that it took the Bodhisattva to practice. All of the conditions that had to be right for him right under that Bodhi tree to realize the Four Noble Truths. All the effort that it's taken down through the years to memorize and pass down the scriptures so that we can have the chance to recite the very beautiful text of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta that we've recited this evening. And that we should all memorize, we should all learn this off by heart. We should make it part of our bones, part of our marrow. You know, and that realization that the Buddha had under that Bodhi tree where he sat there and saw the Four Noble Truths to a depth that cut through everything that was binding him to suffering. That really is the essence of the Dhamma right there. Everything else in Buddhism is superfluous, really. Everything else is just a decoration or maybe a help or a support in some way, but it's not really essential. Only that one thing is essential, that one thing, that realization of the truth within oneself. Only that one thing. So when we're practicing, we need to keep on reminding ourselves of this. It's not just enough to learn it once and then just say, oh yeah, I know that. It has to be something that becomes part of who we are, part of how we relate to everything. Where is that Four Noble Truths inside of ourselves? In other words, how are we creating suffering in this situation because of our desire, our attachment, our inability to let go, our ignorance, our delusion, our hatred, all the many different forms that the defilements take? How are these causing suffering? I always remember one of my favorite teachings, a very short teaching, but from wasn't even really meant as a teaching. It was just a remark. And when Ajahn Sucitto visited here some years ago, and he'd just come from Thailand, and I said, "How was your time in Thailand?" And he said, "Oh, it was all right." He said, "Too much Buddhism." Having lived in Thailand, I knew exactly what he meant. There's too much of all the externals of Buddhism is all there, and it hides the real Dhamma. Of course, the Dhamma is there as well, but it's hard to find it. All the temples are so shiny, they kind of blind you when you're looking at them. You can't actually see the Dhamma anymore. So our practice here in the monastery, and especially during the rains retreat, our practice is nothing else than the realization of these Four Noble Truths. You know, the application of them again and again in every situation, at every level, in every context, every circumstance. You know, it's interesting if you look at the way that the First Noble Truth is structured. It starts out with much more coarse and obvious things, birth, aging and death, and depression and pain and so on, and then goes on to the more subtle suffering of separation from the loved and association with the disliked and so on. These are kind of the pain of through relationships, and then finally ending up with the five aggregates of grasping, five grasping aggregates being suffering. In other words, everything in existence, everything in our experience, especially everything that we take to be a self. So it's interesting, this kind of hierarchy or structure of suffering, if you like, mirrors or echoes the various hierarchies developed in modern psychology to look at the different needs. Most famously, of course, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where you start out with the more basic ones, like food and looking after your physical body and so on, which of course relates to birth, aging and death, and then onto sort of the need for belonging and relationships and so on. And then at the higher levels, the kind of the discovery of one's own identity or self-actualization, as it's called, which corresponds to the understanding the five aggregates of suffering. So there's a movement of these different levels which we have in our psychic life, which we can compare, for example, with the different levels of organization in the physical world, where you have everything from the universe as a whole, the whole cosmos, with all its vastness, and then you have our human level of things, where the earth looks like it's flat from our perspective. And then you have the level of chemicals and subatomic particles and so on and so forth. Many different levels and scales, but at every scale, impermanence applies. Everything is always impermanent, from the smallest up to the biggest. Everything is always conditioned, from the smallest up to the biggest. All of these Dhamma principles apply no matter what aspect of the physical world that we look at. And the same thing applies in our minds. That there are these, if you like, layers or structures or hierarchies that we can tease out and describe with more or less accuracy. But at each level, at each layer, the basic truths of the Dhamma apply. Impermanent suffering, not self. The same general truths apply. And yet, even though these general principles apply, the strategies, how we deal with each layer, will differ. Just as in the physical world, if you want to look at a small scale, you use a microscope. If you want to look at the big scale, you use a telescope. If you want to look at the human scale, then you use a pair of glasses, I guess. So in the same way, in the different levels or layers of suffering in the human mind, each require a different kind of response, and the most straightforward and most obvious of those is the distinction into our acts of body, speech and mind. And you can see the physical acts are the most basic, the verbal acts are second, and then the way we use our mind is the most refined, all of those things. But each of them has its place. We can't just do one or the other. We can't only, for example, do meditation and not change, for example, our sila, and expect to have good results. And we might have some results from doing that, but we're not going to, if we're going to continue doing those behaviors that have caused us stress and caused us suffering, then we can't expect the meditation to progress to any great depth. So each of these aspects of ourselves, aspects of what we do, has to be addressed at its own level. So this is one of the reasons why when we're practicing and trying to practice with the Four Noble Truths, we also keep in mind the Eightfold Path and keep in mind each different factor of the Eightfold Path. And remember that each factor has its own function, and we can't just do away with any of those things if we want our progress to work. Right view has its own function, and that needs to be investigated through understanding, through inquiry, through reading, through sort of discussion, listening, study of the suttas and so on. And this is how we purify our right view. And so for some people that sounds like too much hard work. Some people much, you know, just, I'll just go and sit and meditate and then I don't need to do any study. Well, you can do that and your mind will get peaceful for a while, but it's not going to be a balanced development. And so eventually it's going to come crashing down. And this is the same thing with right thought. So we have to develop that, the way of thinking, the way of using our mind, which is positive and wholesome. And this stage of things is basically equivalent to what in psychology they call CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Basically it means learning to think in a positive or in a skillful way. And of course the effects of this is now very well documented in through psychological studies and so on, that by changing the way that we're thinking, we change our emotions, we change our behaviors and so on and so forth. So it really does have an effect. And this can be tested in MRI scans and all the rest of it. So we learn to train ourselves to think in the right way, to recognize how this pattern where the mind tends to, as I was saying earlier, tends to dwell on the negative. So we tend to dwell on faults or criticisms or doubts, and our mind just keeps on coming back to them and churning them over and over and over. So we need to develop that positive way of thinking. Put effort into that. That's not going to happen just by itself. We need to recognize that those negative thoughts, they're not of any use. They don't actually accomplish anything. And again, there was a nice evolutionary explanation for that that was offered at this conference on the weekend. And it was basically that if you're living in the bush and you hear a rustle in the trees, then, well, the rustle in the trees might be a bear which is going to bite your head off, or it might be a deer which, well, you can have him for dinner. So the choice is, are you going to be dinner or are you going to have dinner? And of course, from an evolutionary perspective, if you know, you can go for a whole year every night, maybe that happens and you can't recognize it. And if you can get it right every time, you can think it's a deer and get it right, but you only have to get it wrong once and then you're finished. So the evolution programs us to be fearful, programs us to look at things in the most negative way. It's better to lose a meal for tonight than it is to be somebody else's meal. So this is kind of very deeply hardwired into kind of mammalian psyche. And you can see that quite a lot with animals in the wild, that they always tend to get afraid or scared and so on if they see you walking through the bush. They don't instantly think that you're going to be friendly. They tend to much more think that you're going to be scary, and only gradually and very slowly will they gain the trust. So we have to recognize these tendencies, and when we recognize them, then we have to put effort into overcoming them. Nobody else can overcome them for us. There's no pill. There's no particular practice that's going to make a magic, you know, magic trick that's going to make these things go away. It's just the ordinary everyday practices that we're learning and practicing here every day. This is what will make these things go away. We can practice through chanting and reciting. It's a very, very wonderful way, very direct way of overcoming unwholesome thoughts and replacing them with wholesome ones. We direct our mind to the Dhamma, we recite, you keep on bringing your mind back to those words of Dhamma which we recite. Again and again and again and again. Remind yourself of that Dhamma again and again and again and again. As we're going through the day, remember the Dhamma, don't let yourself forget it. How many times in the Suttanipata, the verses we've been studying, Nyatakavagga and Parayanavagga, how many times has it said, use the phrase sadasato, ever mindful? So bhikkhu sadasato, that monk being ever mindful, says it again and again and again, ever mindful, sadasato. And keep bringing the Dhamma into mind. Don't let yourself forget it. Don't let yourself just sort of wander off into all of these unwholesome negativities. So we have to put effort to overcome the negativity. We have to put effort into developing the positive thoughts. If we don't put the effort in, then the mind will tend to drift back to the negative thoughts by default. So we need to overcome it. It's easier to break these habits at the stage of thought than it is anywhere else. It's easier to break it through thinking and through using your mind in positive ways than it is through, say, directly addressing emotions. Emotions are more subtle. Emotions are harder to grapple with. So especially when emotions are strong and when it's very hard to deal with them, then by intervening, if you like, at the stage of right thought, we can do something that's quite immediate and will have an immediate effect of giving us some relief from that negativity. And when we have that sense of relief, we can go back and, if there need be, to investigate those emotions more. Actually, a lot of the time the emotions don't need investigating. And this is one of the differences between Buddhism and psychotherapy, at least some forms of it. In psychotherapy, they typically think that problems are something which you need to investigate and uncover the cause of. Whereas in Buddhism, it's more like, why bother? That the problems are... are always going to be coming up. We know what the causes are. The causes are the defilements. What we need to do is to overcome the negativity, let our mind become purified, and then we can address those defilements at a much deeper level that's going to stop them from appearing. Actually, this appears to be a difference between Buddhism and psychotherapy, but actually it's not as different as it appears to be on the surface. Because in psychotherapy, typically, actually the psychoanalysis is really only used to address those causes when they become very strong, when they become dysfunctional. And then that sort of inquiry is used to see if there's any childhood trauma or whatever. But it's not necessarily that everything needs to be investigated in that way. So this is talking about a state of mind which is already much more troubled than a state of mind which is clear and fit and ready for meditation. So from a Buddhist point of view, we realize what those negative thoughts are, those negative emotions, and then we develop positive ones. And again, put work into it. It's actually very fun, and you can just use it, if you want to, you can just invent games and things to play to help you do this. For example, you can just be in your kuti and look around your kuti, look at every nail in your kuti, and then realize actually somebody put that nail there. Somebody had the mindfulness and the energy and the diligence to put that nail there so that I can enjoy this kuti. Sadhu, 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 isn't that wonderful? And you can do a whole 5-minute meditation on that nail, and then you move to the next nail and do another 5-minute meditation on that nail. And you go through every nail in your kuti. You can go through all the things that you own. Look around you, look at the things, look at the pillowcase, the coffee cup, the curtains. And recollect that somebody made these things. Somebody produced them, somebody's work, somebody gave up their time. Somebody transported them, somebody manufactured them, somebody supplied the raw materials. And all of those things have ended up with you being here and being able to use them. So this is a way of using our mind in a positive sense. Or we can go through all of the people in the monastery and just reflect on the people in the monastery and just take some time to go through everybody and recollect on their good qualities. So like I said before, 5 good qualities equals 1 bad one. So you can start with 5. Go every person. Find 5 good qualities. Yeah? So I think Venerable Nandiya is the closest. He's very intelligent. He has a lot of faith. He's very diligent doing his duties in the monastery. He's very helpful in many kinds of ways. And he has a lot of dedication towards learning the Dhamma. So there's 5 good qualities just off the top of my head. I'm not privileging him, it's just because he happens to be closest, alright? So it could have been anybody. It's very easy to think of 5 good qualities that anybody has. Very easy. Actually, everybody in this room has hundreds, thousands of good qualities. And it's very easy to recollect them. It doesn't have to be profound things. Simple is good. Yeah? Simple is good. Somebody opened the door mindfully. That's something good. We can do sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And so as well as just making that a private thing and recollecting, then also, carry that over into our action and do things. So again, we're very lucky here. We have this whole monastery which is built on the practice of dana. Everything is dana all the time. And so learn to appreciate it. Learn to appreciate those people who are preparing the food every day. Appreciate the work that people are doing in the office, and drop by the office every now and then and just poke your head in and say, thanks for doing this, I really appreciate it. Yeah, stop by the people who are doing the work in the shed, or someone's doing some sweeping, and just say, oh, thanks for doing that, I really appreciate it. Make sure that people know that what they do and what they say is appreciated, and especially sometimes the quiet ones. Because in a monastery, monasteries tend to be a very introverted people, tend to come to monasteries. So a lot of people are very quiet, they don't speak much, or they're not very confident about going out and doing things and so on. And so it's nice to reach out to people who are like that and just just give a quiet expression of thanks or gratitude or appreciation for something. It's just these little things that make living in a monastery so wonderful, to be able to appreciate. You know, I always do think it's amazing how many things that we have, the Dhamma has opened up for us, you know, which just is not available to anybody else. I mean, just as a recent example, just a conference we went to on the weekend, and we think about it, that, you know, we managed to go down there, somebody had the kindness to drive us, somebody had the kindness to put us up overnight, somebody had the kindness to feed us, and somebody had the kindness to pay for our, you know, we went to a conference, everybody else had to pay, and we went there for free, and listened to these wonderful speakers and teachers. And we had such an incredible opportunity to learn at a very, very high level of wisdom and understanding and insight and knowledge. And all of that just given to us just because we said, oh yeah, we'd like to go. And then there's kind of no questions and no doubts or anything. It's just there. And if we didn't want to take it up, that's fine. We can stay in the monastery, be quiet, and do our meditation. And that's also fine. And that's just one thing. That's just something that just happened this weekend. It could be a million things that the Dhamma has made available to us, the opportunities that we have. So it's really an essential part of our practice all the time, is to reflect on these things, not to be dwelling on the negative, but to be constantly appreciating, constantly having this kind of sense of gratitude. This is the quality that you always see in people who have good meditation. And good meditation is not the outcome of spending all day, every day doing meditation and never doing anything else. I mean, yes, that's useful in some contexts, in some cases. But it's mostly useful if your mind's ready for it, if your mind's skillful and wholesome, and that's what you're ready to go and do it. So I know plenty of people who kind of have that good energy and that positive energy, who've trained themselves to use their mind in that way, trained themselves always to be grateful, always to have faith in the Dhamma, always to have generosity and of spirit, and always to have that big heart. And even though they might live busy lives and do many things, and they still have good meditation. But I also know plenty of people who are very negative, very critical, who are very kind of cynical and down and so on. And they get a kind of distaste for the world, withdraw into seclusion. And there's a kind of underlying aversion to it. And their meditation, that never goes very well, never really progresses. And spend years and years and years in solitude and never really get anywhere. So it's so important that we understand the right place, the right level for our practice, so that we're putting our work in the right spot. And the test of that, what's a sign if that's working, is when suffering is overcome. And because suffering, we all suffer at our own level of suffering, don't we? You know, you see, you know, when we're living in the monastery, we maybe suffer because, you know, somebody didn't do their chores when they're supposed to do their chores, or somebody said something that we didn't like, or whatever. We have these kinds of suffering. And everybody has the different forms of suffering. There's an image in my mind which I haven't been able to get out, well, I have been able to get out, but it keeps coming back into my mind the last week or two. There was a collection of the best photographs from the last year, and the most striking photographs, I think, in the Guardian, and one of them was a photograph from the famine in Somalia. And it was a famine in Somalia, it might have been somewhere else, I can't remember exactly now. and it was a little girl starving to death, just skin and bones. You've seen so many photos of these little African children, just skin and bones, and so pitiful to look at, crawling along the road. And the remark said that it was like, you know, it was miles to the next, to the refugee center where she could get some food. And the photographer who took this, the image was crying as he saw her just crawling so pitifully along the road. But the thing that really makes that photograph so devastating is that just behind her was a vulture seated, standing on the road just waiting for her to drop dead. And when you look at that and you look at that suffering, even though that picture makes it so dramatic, that's just ordinary life. There are people starving to death every day, hundreds of them. There are children dying every day, thousands all around the world. There are people dying of AIDS. There are people dying in violence. What's happening right now, right? While I'm giving this Dhamma talk, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of people all around the world who've died since I've started giving this Dhamma talk. This is ordinary, everyday suffering. It's happening. This is what it's like to be human. This is the human condition. And so it's so important for us to bear this in mind, to remember that our suffering seems so real to us. When somebody says something we don't like or something, we worry about it and we get concerned about it and all of these things. But you know, that suffering that we feel inside ourselves, that is within our control. Okay, fair enough, if there's nothing to eat, then maybe that's not in our control. We can't do anything about it, there's just nothing to eat. But the kind of suffering that we feel when we have a place to stay, we have food to eat every day, we have all of the things that we need, then that suffering that we feel is entirely 100% up to us. It's how we practice. It's what we decide to do with it. That's the Four Noble Truths. And as soon as we start saying, oh no, I can't, then that's just saying, well, I'm not going to practice in accordance with the Four Noble Truths. I'm going to reject the Four Noble Truths. Do something else. So always remember that the Buddha said that he would never ask people to do something that was impossible. Absolutely never. He would only ask them to do what's possible. He said if it was not possible to abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome, then he would not ask people to do it. But it is possible. That's why he does ask you to develop the wholesome and abandon the unwholesome. And when we think about the profundity of the Dhamma, when we think about how intractable and how difficult even simple emotions and simple states of mind can be to overcome, how much we get caught up even just in little things, then it can feel impossible to realize these profound things, profound teachings of the Dhamma. But we have to realize that it's just this one thing. It's this one unwholesome thing. Is that possible to abandon that? This one mind of anger. Is it possible to abandon that? Well, of course it is. We've all done it. We've all abandoned anger before. That one mind of greed, that one mind of delusion. We've all done it many, many times. It is possible. So we just have to do it one more time. And then one more time again. That's all. And that's up to us. Nobody can do it for us. That's what this monastery is for. That's why we've set this monastery up like that. Like the way it is. It's done specifically and solely to give you the maximum chance to take your time, be slow, be careful, understand in yourself that wholesome and that unwholesome, abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. Remembering the Four Noble Truths. Remembering that we have the power, we have the choice. And this is my little talk for you this evening on the Four Noble Truths and on practicing and applying that. So I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.